My wife Megumi does a Japanese tea ceremony, and that's how we met. She had been practicing tea since she was in junior high, and I went to study with the same tea teacher when I was studying in Japan in my mid-20s. And I don't remember much about the tea ceremony. But our tea teacher is an extraordinary person. I had many, many great masters and teachers, especially in Japan. I had teachers in this country, but especially in Japan, in the 5 years I spent from when I was 24 until 29. And most of them were in their 70s and 80s when I got to know them. And it was very fortunate for me because many of them had a reputation of being extremely hard on their students, but I happened to encounter them when they were, you know, very sort of gentle. There's an expression in Japanese, Momokuri san ne kaki hachi ne. Peaches and chestnuts take 3 years before they'll bear nuts and fruit. Persimmons, 8 years. What an issue. But I will take a whole lifetime. And this was a Zen monk. Yeah. But persimmons, you know, they take longer to bear fruit. And then when they first bear fruit, they're very green and very bitter. And then over time, the fruit becomes more, takes on yellowish, orangish hue, becomes deeper color of orange than red, very full color, and then it starts to decay, so it starts to lose that clear shape and starts to get brownish spots or redder spots or soft spots, and then eventually drops to the ground. But in that process, you know, all kinds of different animals will climb a persimmon tree and eat its fruit. And, you know, will attract birds and squirrels. But animals that can't reach the persimmons, you know, have to wait until it drops. And when it drops, it's so soft and so sweet that any animal can, you know, enjoy its sweet flavor. And I was so fortunate that I encountered my teachers when they were on the ground already. Because I myself was so green and bitter that I was not very digestible. And so I was so fortunate to meet so many great teachers who were at that stage where I could, you know, where I could digest them and they could digest me. And they've all long since passed. The only one who remains is our tea teacher. And so I'm looking forward to seeing her. She's in an assisted living facility, but she's still full of spirit. Yeah. And a few years ago when I went to visit her, not the last time I saw her, but the time before that, my wife and I tend to go to Japan separately, or we would at most overlap by a few days because one of us had to be with our cats. And so I was in Japan and I was giving talks at the local Buddhist university and I had a number of people to see. And I was only there for 8 days. And I was very busy and I took care of all my things and I only had one more day and I hadn't gone to see her. Thought, well, maybe, you know, it's just a little too much this time. But I thought, but she's 95 years old and you might not have another chance to see her, Mark, I was telling myself. So you better go see her. So I called my wife. She said, yeah, she's moved to a different facility and it's not that far from Ryokoin, which is the temple that I used to live at. She says, it's walking distance. So I said, okay. So it's in the northwestern part of Kyoto. So I started walking up the street. And people in Japan are used to walking because a lot of people don't drive, they just take public transportation. So I was walking for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and it's going farther and farther up the hill. And as I go farther up the hill, there's more and more bamboo groves and more greenery. It's very lush. And it put me in a kind of a pensive mood. I finally reached the facility. I had called ahead and I said, "I'm coming." And so if you would just let her know that I'm coming, they said, "Oh yes, we'll be waiting for you." And I arrived, and both from having had the time to just sort of kind of reflect and also going deeper into the greenery, I just had this kind of quieter feeling as I went in. And in these facilities, you're supposed to take off your shoes and put on the institutional slippers they have. So I took off my shoes and I said, "My name's Mark Uno, and I'm here to see, you know, Mrs. Yanagida." Her husband had long since passed. And they said, "Oh, she's in room 130, right over there." So I started to go in her direction, and she was waiting in the doorway to her room, sitting in her wheelchair. Because her whole career she had been teaching tea, and she would teach every Sunday. And she would be there from about 8 or 9 in the morning until, you know, 5 or 6 in the evening. And she'd be sitting in seiza with her legs folded underneath her knees. So all those many years of sitting like that had ruined her knees. And so she couldn't sit like that anymore. She couldn't really walk. So she was sitting in a wheelchair. And I had an opportunity to be with many monks, many masters. But even among them, she had done years and years of Zen practice. I just remember how straight her spine was. It was like there was a steel rod going through her spine. Like this. And that's what struck me when I saw her. Even at 95, she was just perfectly straight. And I approached her, and she turned towards me. And then she bowed like this. "Yanagida de gozaimasu. Donata de irashaimasu ka?" She says, "I am Yanagida. And who might you be?" She didn't recognize me. And even though there might have been a very brief moment in which I was disappointed, it was a much bigger impact. It was almost like I was struck by lightning in that moment. Because if I were 95 years old and I was in a nursing home and somebody that I didn't even know who that was wanted to visit me, I'd say, "Go away." But there she was waiting for me in the entry to her room. And she bowed like she had always bowed. So dignified, so noble. "I am Yanagida, and who might you be?" She couldn't remember my name. She didn't recognize my face. She didn't have any possessions. You know, that is attaining the mirror. It's not the mind. It's in her mirror. It's like, I don't know who's coming, but it doesn't matter. Because whoever it is an honored guest who's blessing me with their presence. And I'm going to receive them as the honored guest they are. She's not thinking any of this, but it's there. That moment I realized I really needed to come see her. Just to receive that teaching one more time. Then she says, "Dozo irashai." She says, "Please come into my humble room." It's like a 6x8 room. There's like a cot and a sink and a mini fridge and a small TV, and that's it. Please sit down. I sat down, a little chair, I sat down. Well, you know, again, it's in her bones. It's like, I don't have anything to give you. So, and she says, well, there's this book here. And her father was a scholar and a philosopher, very well respected, right? So that's still in her. She's very learned, especially for women of her generation. Women of her generation didn't go to university. They went to what they call jogakko, which is almost like finishing school. But she was just, you know, studied on her own and did Zen practice with the monks, where very, very few people were admitted. And one of the, at Shokokuji, which is one of the great houses of Zen in Kyoto, and the person who helped her get permission to sit was the great philosopher Nishitani, who was one of my teachers, who also I got to know in the twilight of his life. And she shared with me that Nishitani would sit in Sesshin with, in meditation retreat 1 week, right? Sitting next to her to support her, sitting all night long without lying down. And it's freezing cold. There's no heat. It's 30 degrees outside, it's 30 degrees inside. That was who he really was. So she was just this amazing, amazing spirit. And she's trying to offer something. She pulls off this book off the shelf. She says, kore ii desho, kore. She's reading a blurb from the cover that says, We all live having been given the gift of life. She says, isn't this beautiful? I said, yes. She says, please take this. I said, you know, it's rude not to receive it, but it's like she has like two books, so I received it. I took it home. She says, I don't know. I don't have anything else to give you. And she says, see, I don't even have room for a Buddha altar in here. So I have my Juzu, my rosary, I have it next to TV, and now my TV's my Buddha altar. So she says, I just turn it off and then I bow to the TV as if it's the Buddha himself. She says, and she says, here, why don't you take my rosaries? It's all she has. It's all she has. And she's trying to give it to me. I said, I can't take this. She says, no, it's okay. I said, no. But it's not, she's not doing it to be unselfish. It's just natural. And no one's saying here that we should do that. We should do what comes naturally. But, you know, it's like this expression, the scent of the Buddha rubs off from the robes. You know, it rubs off from the robes onto our own bodies. So it's all just, you know, it all just became part of her. Just through bowing and bowing and bowing, and just herself being the recipient of the generous gift of the Dharma over and over and over. And I always set myself an allowance, given all the expenses and whatever, for buying gifts, right? So, and then I can only carry so much in my suitcase, so I have tricks that I use. Like when I need to go visit someone and I've run out of gifts down the street from where my in-laws live, because my in-laws are very, very elderly, but still, you know, pretty active, 91 and 87. And down the street from where they live in Kyoto, there's an American Goods store. So I pop into the American Goods store and I buy something and say, for you, all the way from America. But even there I have an allowance, right? So I use up my allowance. So I was thinking maybe I wasn't going to go see her. So I've used up my allowance. So I'm thinking the thing that, you know, she's eating institutional food, so I think something good to eat. But my wife's already told me fresh food isn't allowed because it'll get rotten, and if it, you know, goes bad, then the institution's liable. So something that's not going to rot, it's hot. And the Japanese are very, very inventive, so they have all these really subtle delicious tasting jellies, summer jellies, that each one is packed in its own little aluminum cup. You just peel it off, and it even comes with its own little plastic spoons, and they're tiny, tiny, right? And there are all these really tasty flavors, like a citrus or sweet bean or green tea. And they come in so many different, they're all neatly wrapped. Package of 32, package of 16, package of 12, package of 6, right? And I'm just looking at my allowance, and I've used up all my money, so I get the little package of four. And I'm kind of ashamed because she doesn't have anything. She wants to give everything she has left in this earthly world to me. But I want to present it to her. So I say, Yanagida-sensei, I just have a small gift for you. She says, oh, you shouldn't have. You don't need to bring it. So please go ahead and open. She opens it. And you know what she said? Ma, konnani takusan. これ皆さんと一緒にいただきましょう。She says, so much. We'll have to share it with everyone. Nobody knows this, but I've never really shared it. But you know, I get the gadget problem. I get the gadget desire. Things that really don't even cost that much. Like, Mark, aren't 6 power drills enough? No. I have the drill driver. I have the quarter drill. I have the hammer drill. I have the impact drill. You know, I have the corded hammer drill. But you know, I'm looking through my email. Today only! And I don't usually get hooked, but then every once in a while I get hooked. Here's this little thing that if I bought it, oh, surely it would make your life so wonderful. And I don't think about it consciously, but you know, this is the effect of the Dharma. That there's somebody like Mrs. Yanagida and all my other great teachers. See? Less stuff's better. Give it away. Yeah. It's so beautiful. Just so beautiful. Yeah, Dogen right there. Just completely embodied. Daihai Tokusei. Bowing and attaining the mirror. It's right there. That's it. It's no ordinary thing. It's ordinary thing, just bowing, but no ordinary thing. If every time I got upset, colleague, wife, a cat, if every time I got upset, I could just bow. No problems ever. But no, I can't. But Buddha says, that's the one I want. The one that can't bow. Not the one that can bow. That's not very interesting. That's the one I love. I'm confused. That's the one I love. Confused. Is it Mike?
Yes.
Yeah. Confused Mike. Of course, I love clear Mike also. But confused Mike, whatever Mike is now, is Buddha Mike. Right? Yeah. Angry Buddha, happy Buddha, whatever it is. There's no separation between Shinran and Dogen. Shin Wei, Dogen Wei. Affirm the delusion, which is the fertilizer for the realization of Buddha nature, true and trusting, boundless compassion. Like a box and a lid. Lid is foolish being, box is Buddha nature, box is boundless compassion. Just realize. So simple. many koans, all koans, same koan. Very simple. As I said, I've been so fortunate to have so many great encounters, so many great students who became my teachers. Just taking the journey, just taking the journey with me. Began my career at Brown University, not so far from here. I still stay in touch with some of my students from then. They've gone to become their own professors. Just amazing. Published more books than I have, and gone on to accomplish so many things. And then from Carleton College in Minnesota, one of my best students, Emily, that I've talked about in other contexts, she worked with women and children in South America during her time at Carleton, and then afterwards also went back on a Fulbright. And then when she was done, I got a communication from her, email saying, "Mark, I'm not sure what I would like to do next. I need to come back to the U.S., but I'm having a really hard time thinking about it because I've seen so much of the devastation that the major corporations, even U.S. government, have wrought in South America that I'm very angry. And I think I need to do meditation. So can you recommend some place where I can go and do meditation?" I said, "Well, you go to San Francisco. There's oodles of Zen groups in San Francisco, including San Francisco Zen Center. But the problem is it's very expensive to live in the Bay Area." So I said, "Well, we have Eugene Zendo here, and he's a young monk, but I like the young monk here at Eugene Zendo here in Eugene, so you could try coming here." Now, I wasn't being that serious about it, but she showed up. And she had trained as a school teacher, and there was an opening in the local high school, so she immediately got a job as a high school English literature teacher. And so she lived in Eugene, and eventually her boyfriend joined her, and a great, great guy named Arturo, who was also one of my students at Carleton. But they kind of split, and they tried to get back together. Other things were happening. And I kept saying, "Well, whatever you want to do, if you like to be a school teacher, that's great, but it's very grueling, right? Anybody who's been a school teacher, my mother was a school teacher, it's very grueling. It's morning till night, you're underpaid." So I said, "If you want to effect change in the ways that you're thinking about, you might think about graduate school." But I knew that that was also difficult because after having the real world experience, being stuck in the classroom, dealing with abstractions, also difficult. But she finally applied to PhD programs in modern Latin American history, and she got into a very good one at University of California, San Diego. So, she was very happy about it. I was happy to see her go off. And then about a year and a half later, I got another communication saying, "Mark, I'm not sure if this is the right place for me, and I'm thinking of quitting, and I've also met someone, and I'm not sure what to do." So having known her, she had lost her father when she was young, so I wasn't a father figure for her, but somewhat, played that role. So I just sensed that she had kind of already decided what she wanted to do, but it would have been nice for her to just receive that affirmation. So I immediately wrote back and I just said, "You have absolutely no obligation to do anything for anyone. You just picked the best path for you." And soon after, she said, "Mark, I've decided I'm leaving the program, I'm getting married." And since she was a time, she was an undergraduate student. She says, Mark, I just want babies. And she had this very incredibly mature, incredibly maternal personality since she was like 19 or 20. So then she said, you know, I made so many friends in Eugene that even though we're having our wedding ceremony in San Diego, we're going to have a reception. Eugene, can you come? And so I went, and she introduced me to her husband, Chris. Just a wonderful, wonderful guy. So gentle. He's really tall, like 6'5". But so gentle. So such a gentle giant. So gentle. And it was delightful to meet them. And then soon after, baby, right? What she always wanted. Wonderful. So just that New Year's, around New Year's, we'd exchange greetings or whatever. But then suddenly, a couple years ago, so I guess this was towards the end of 2012, I got an urgent message from Chris saying, Mark, I wanted to let you know that Emily's very, very ill, and she said you would want to know. So I immediately wrote back and said, thank you for letting me know, and I hope everything's going to be all right. Right? And I said, I'll write to Emily soon. But it was such a busy time for me because the Dalai Lama thing was getting underway. I didn't have time to write back to her. But then, in mid-November, I got another message saying, Mark, Emily had another round of chemo, and we thought she was just tired from the chemo. She was sleeping so much. But the doctors are now telling us that it's because her organs are shutting down and she might not have much time left. So I said, I'll be right there. I'll be on the next flight. He says, no, because she's undergoing another round of chemo and she can't, she's really not functional right after that. So why don't you come a little bit later? So I said, well, when should I come? How about first week of December? He says, that's perfect. So I booked a flight for December 6th. And then on November 26th, I received another email. We don't think Emily's going to make it. Emily says that she's in such pain that she might not be able to hold on. So I said, I'll be there tomorrow. So I contacted Alaska Horizon, and they said, I said, look, I'll pay whatever the change fee is. It's to go see a student who's dying, a former student who's dying. He said, well, let me just hold on. So the person who I reached came back about 5 minutes later and said, we don't usually make this an exception for non-family, but in this case, we're just going to charge you the $100 change fee. Otherwise, you would have to pay $500 more. I said, thank you so much. So I got on the plane at like 7:30 the next morning and it flew into San Diego at 9:30 or so. It's right near the UCSD Hillcrest Medical Center, so I called and they came to get me. And Emily was already halfway on the other side. Her eyes were closed, and you know, I could tell that she was still there. And I squeezed her ankle hard around the acupressure points. And suddenly her eyes opened. And she looked right at me. But she couldn't say anything. It was like Emily was inside there, but very, very far away. And she tried to move her mouth. But I said, don't worry, Emily, don't worry. Just relax. I think I know what you're thinking. You don't have to worry. Because Emily was such a perfectionist that she was worried about unfinished business, not being good enough. This was her worry. Are my kids going to be okay? Is Chris going to be okay? Is my mom going to be okay? And what about all the relationships that I don't feel like I reached out far enough, that I don't feel like I really truly completed? And I just leaned over and I said, Emily, you have done so much, you have loved so much, you have given so much, so much more than people who have lived 10, 20, 30, 40 years longer than you. But everyone has unfinished business. But that's what makes us human. And in that we're completely embraced just as we are. Just then, nurses brought in her newborn baby, who had to be given birth prematurely because they can't give chemo to somebody who's pregnant. So Eloise was just like 1 month old, just tiny, tiny baby. And she's in the preemie ward, so they brought her in. Emily can't move. So Chris and Emily's mom put the baby next to Emily's head and moved Emily's hands to embrace the baby. And the nurse said, look, the oxygen monitor on the baby, Eloise, just zoomed up to 100%. And look at Emily's heart monitor. Suddenly, it's beating 5 beats per minute slower. Because Emily's heart could relax into being the mother who knows her baby's there. One life just getting ready to leave this world, and the other life just emerging into this world. But in that moment, mother and daughter, their hearts beat as one. Emily had made videos, sang songs, wrote letters to both Miles, her baby boy, and to Eloise. And Chris had made all of these materials for them for when Emily would be gone. But in that moment, I realized Eloise will never, ever remember that Emily held her every day for that half hour or hour during that 4 or 5 weeks that they had together. But everything essential for Eloise to live, Emily gave her. Her mother's love and the love of the universe embraced in boundless compassion. And I realized I was just given the miracle of life and death in that moment. And I put on my robes. Chris and Emily's mom, they had no exposure to Buddhism. But I said, we're going to do some chanting together. And I took out the Juseige. So you don't have to worry about the words. Just know, this is the song of oneness. Emily, no matter what happens, no matter where you go, Chris's heart, your mom's heart, Miles, Eloise's heart, are one with your heart forever and ever and ever. And your heart, your great heart, your heart of boundless compassion will be one with Chris's heart and your mom's heart and Miles and Eloise forever and ever and ever. And whether you can see it or feel it or not. It doesn't matter. Boundless compassion will always and always be with you and for you and is you. And what I try to do, whether it's there in the hospital room or in a Shin temple or here at Greater Boston Zen Center, when we do the chanting, is to do my best to just feel the rhythm of the chanting as it arises. See, this is other power. I'm leading the chanting, but you're leading me with your energy. And I could feel the huge heart that Emily had and that she still has, just pulling us more powerfully than I usually feel it, just pulling us through the chanting. And as her heart pulled us through the chanting, just tears just came flowing out of my eyes and out of Chris and his mom, just crying and crying and crying. Yes! Tears of profound sadness, but even greater love and beauty. Later, Lynn, Emily's mom, said to me, "You know, Mark, from the time that Emily was a small child, she always wanted to do so much. She even used to say to me, 'Mom, I wish sleep were optional.' Now I know why. Because she sensed this time, her time on earth was limited. And she had to hurry up and have the experience of having Miles and Eloise." Emily's father died of cancer at the age of 34. Emily died of cancer at the age of 34. And after Emily passed, after I left, another one of Emily's students, somebody else went to visit. There was just a stream of visitors. It was almost like a pilgrimage to see St. Emily. And one of Emily's students from South Eugene High School made the trip to visit her. But by the time she arrived, Emily had already passed. And Abby is her name. Abby sent me an email message. "I feel that Emily was definitely aware that I went to San Diego, as she recently visited me in my dreams, and we had a very clear, vivid conversation. She asked me how her children are, and I assured her they're being cared for, and that everything will be okay. Then, I think to console me, she explained to me why she had to die. Her suffering was just too great, and she was in so much pain." And it was so amazing to read this, because that's what Chris had told me, Emily had told everyone, that she just couldn't hang on because the pain was so intense. But she had not told Abby this. Only in Abby's dream did Emily convey this to Abby. "I stood on a tall sandstone cliff, and Emily's face was in the sky above the ocean at Torrey Pines State Reserve, her favorite spot to go hiking. And I went there during my visit. She told me she didn't like writing poetry indoors anyway, and that now she could be outside all the time, where she felt complete creative freedom. She seemed very peaceful and godlike. The dream was so vivid, I can still picture it and hear our discussion. I feel she has been in my life for a much higher purpose and continues to be a teacher, both in life and in death, far beyond the classroom." It was so amazing to read this email. And Abby wanted to have a memorial service in Eugene, so I helped her with it. And then just about a year later, Chris let me know that they were having a memorial service for Emily in Washington State, where her family came from, at her neighbor's house, where Emily played all the time. So he asked me if I could be there, and I was really, really busy, but I really wanted to be there. So I went. It was a beautiful, beautiful place on the other side of Puget Sound from Seattle, overlooking a lake. Just absolutely gorgeous. And I got to meet all of Emily's friends and extended family and uncles and aunts and cousins and nieces and nephews and a bunch of students from my Carleton days that I hadn't seen for a long time. And I realized, even now, a year after her passing away, she was bringing people together and giving me another gift. It was just so amazing. Just so amazing. It was almost like a dream. Where am I? Really, is this happening? I never thought that I would really have an opportunity to have deep and wonderful experiences as a teacher, as a priest. And I received so much more than I could ever, ever have in my wildest dreams imagined. And over and over and over, I make a journey to be a bridge to others. And it turns out that they are the ones building the bridges, bringing the gift of other power to me, other than ego, a boundless compassion, the ocean of light. And now, all of you have brought this gift to me. To see your Zen Center here in this beautiful space. To know that you have this great leader here in Josh Bartok. To see the unfolding and flowering of Laura and Stephen and all that they are. For you, and for each other, and for me. It's just so wonderful. And it's hard to believe that some of my friends from Buddhist Faith Fellowship, how many years have we already known each other? That you've made this journey too. Just so amazing. But also new faces and new friends. But just like the cherry petals scattering to the wind, just one time only. I hope I see some of you folks at Barry or wherever we may meet again. But you will have changed, and I will have more gray hair, and I will have less hair. And so we will all be different. Each time, just like one cherry blossom, just like one human life in the great arc of the universe, just one time we get this chance to join our palms and receive this moment now. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo. Laura, why don't you set up... Oh, that would be fine. You could stay there. And you're going to lead us in Jusege.